But at any rate, let's get back to
Ross
versus Consumers Power on rehearing. Now, this time, the court, I think, invested a great deal of effort in trying to do it right. Do you remember that? There were about 9 cases, I think, that were combined. And I think that it was sort of a melange, by and large, large majority of the court, 5 or 6, swung with most of the decisions. And various circumstances. One was a drowning case in the social services of camp out in Lake Michigan. And then here was a drainage ditch fact situation with Ross. And there were all kinds of things in between. Did you recall what you thought about that case, and did it do about what a court is able to do to straighten out that kind of a subject matter?
Roger, I must say I don't have any strong memory of how I felt about that process at the time. I do recall what you said, and that is that I was very sensitive that the trial bar, and I knew many, many, many trial lawyers from this area, southeastern Michigan, because of my time on the trial bench, and they would, in appropriate circumstances, remind me that they didn't know what to tell their clients about this burgeoning potential business and governmental liability. And so I was very sensitive that we needed to do what all of us in the court agreed to do, and that is to try to gather together a group of representative types of torts, accident cases. So we got the 9 or so that you described. And, of course, we had complicated our task times 9 to do it that way, because it's sometimes far easier to write a principle of law into the jurisprudence when the facts are discrete and relative to one event, a drowning in a drainage ditch. But when you got 9 different events, schoolyard accidents and auto accidents and the rest of it, it's more difficult to write with precision. You have to write more broadly. So the product which we turned out in Ross versus Consumers Power was, I think, a contribution to straightening out the jurisprudence, to be sure, but we necessarily straightened it out in a way which was imperfect, because we were trying to write to 9 different factual scenarios. Some litigation was generated thereafter and was addressed after I left the court, so obviously we did it imperfectly. But I thought we did about as best we could. I don't remember where I came down in those cases.
Well, let me ask about a sort of a tangential aspect of this. I mentioned already that in the first Ross versus Consumers Power ended in a 3-3 deadlock, and this was because Justice Moody had died shortly before the time for disposing of this matter. And then the court came back, and it was, I think, a full 2 years later with this blockbuster, systematic, very intense, highly organized way of trying to deal with the problem. Was there something about the kind of deadlock situation that resulted from Justice Moody's death where the court had a most extraordinary problem with a great engorgement of judicial work, 70% and 95% done, and a lot of potential 3-3 splits? Was there some result from the Moody experience in these splits and having to adopt the opinions and all that that perhaps chastened the court a little bit in the future in its attempt to carry on in, a more orderly, systematic way? Or am I just making wind here?
You're not making wind, but my memory is that while we recognized that we had a terrific problem because of the 3-3 split cases, we did not have any real effective means to do anything about it. After all, if the court is divided at a time when the court is shorthanded, and there's an even number of justices, you can strive mightily to re-examine your position, to try to avoid an even split in order to get the cases decided. But there's a point beyond which one cannot go. And we had many fewer cases during that short period that were going to be 50-50 splits, 3-3, mm-hmm. than turned out, because all of us tried mightily to find out whether we could re-examine our tentative first position and shift over to help create a majority. And one can do that with honor if what assigns you tentatively to one side of the case is a minor procedural point of some kind, which is not as big as the issue itself. Still, there were a lot of cases. The result of the 3-3 split on the governmental immunity cases, of course, is there was a big backup in the pipeline. Trial judges didn't know how to rule because the Supreme Court didn't. Lawyers didn't know how to advise clients in their offices. It was a bigger disaster than most of us in the court really appreciated at the time. But nothing we could do about it except urge the governor to make an appointment fast.
Just from sort of an objective historical view, do you recall when the news of Justice Moody's death came? At this time, maybe we can double back and go into the procedure why this was so, but here you had a great mass of work ready to be dumped out the end of the pipeline. And do you recall how it was that I noticed there are many cases, or several anyway, in the reports that show that right at the introductory remark that two or three or maybe one judge had, or justice of the Supreme Court, had adopted the Moody draft opinion, which was in a very advanced stage, mm-hmm. and then others agreed, and the case was disposed of. Do you remember what the procedure, how you reacted when you all got together at conference? How was the problem perceived?
Right? I don't really remember it in detail. Blair's death was sudden, and it wasn't. There was no illness in advance of it, which would get us to think about maybe we ought to be prepared for something. As you know, he died of a heart attack. I got a phone call from his court reporter at my home at about 20 minutes after 5 or so one morning, and the court got together almost immediately and began to address this problem. The first thing we had to do was find out the size of the problem, how many cases were pending, and how many among those cases that were pending had we indicated a tentative vote that was going to be now evenly divided. There weren't too many, actually. We, after oral arguments each day, we always had a brief post-argument conference, and we would indicate our tentative direction, whether to affirm or reverse. So we had this unofficial and tentative vote on a piece of paper as to all the cases Blair had participated in. There weren't actually too many, but unfortunately, one of them was a case which had a long tail, and that was the governmental immunity case, for which hundreds of cases were in the system in Michigan, awaiting disposition, waiting for our rule. So, no, I don't remember, Roger, that we saw that as such a big crisis.